Hello and welcome to another episode of the Metaphysical Podcast. Welcome to another full moon. This is Victoria Duda bringing you the Metaphysical Podcast from Zenith Lifestyle. Episode 5, We Are Such Stuff as Dreams Are Made Of. Ever since the beginning of human history, it seems to be that we humans live two lives. We live our everyday waking life, and then we have a secret life in the middle of the night, when we close our eyes, when we go to sleep, and we begin to dream. The oldest recorded story that we know of in history is the story of Gilgamesh that dates back many thousand years. And this story begins with a dream. Because at the beginning of the story, we see the king of Uruk, Gilgamesh, who is at the beginning of the story a great despot. He's terrorizing his own people. He's only living for his own pleasures, and he makes all the men in the city constantly exercising, constantly participating in some sports and in some competitions that are designed to please the king. And the people are complaining that they have no time for work and they have no time for love. And he takes all the women. There is an ancient jus primae noctis institution in the city that says that every virgin has to sleep with Gilgamesh before they get to spend a night with their husbands. So the regime of Gilgamesh is a regime of terror. And it would go on like that if not for a dream. But Gilgamesh one night goes to sleep, and in his dream he looks up into the night sky. And he sees that there is a star that falls down right in front of his feet. And he wants to lift it, he wants to move it, but he cannot because the star is so heavy. And the people come and they start to kiss its feet. And Gilgamesh himself starts to be so drawn to that star, like it would be a woman. So he goes and tells his mother about this dream. And the way his mother interprets that dream is particular to the antique world. She interprets it as an allegorical story, saying that that star that you dreamt of, my son, is a helper who will come into your life and who will change your life. And as the story goes on, yes, there is a helper coming because the gods are sending a friend to this Gilgamesh, a friend who is half beast, half man, and who is supposed to tame the king by bringing in the animal nature of man, the instinctual nature of man. And as the two merge, as the two become good friends, the story gets new meaning and life is beginning to change in Uruk. But let's look at the dream now. From a modern, more psychoanalytic perspective, what does that mean that a star is coming into one's life? A modern psychologist would probably say that it is a symbol for illumination. It is a symbol for something from a higher world, from the world of the higher self, is descending into our everyday life. It's descending to make us wiser, to make us more mature, to help us to evolve. And virtually every spiritual tradition acknowledges that. The dreams have the power to change us. Dreams have the power to teach us. In many traditions, I'm thinking especially of shamanic traditions, dreams are also regarded as a gate into another state of consciousness, where we meet ourselves, but we meet a different type of ourselves. We meet our double. We meet our spiritual double. There is a very interesting dream description in an ancient Chinese book that is written by Cao Hsüngqin, The Dream of the Red Chamber. And this novel says the story of Pao Yu, who is a master, a wealthy and aristocratic man, who has a lot of women who are his servants or his playthings. And one night this Pao Yu goes to sleep and he dreams. He dreams that he's himself, but he goes into the gardens where all his women are, and They don't recognize him. They laugh at him. They say, "Who are you?" He says, "I'm Pao Yu, but you are not Pao Yu. Pao Yu is our master. You are someone else. You're an imposter." And the women laugh and leave. And then something remarkable happens because Pao Yu wakes up and goes to his women and says, "I had a remarkable dream. I dreamt that I was in my dream and I was calling you. And you didn't come with me and you didn't come to me because you thought I was someone else." And the women said, "But you are someone else." And that's when Pao Yu wakes up again. It's a story of a so-called false awakening, when a dream is in a dream and in a dream. And the message that comes across in this story is that we are searching for another ourselves in a dream. When we are in a dream, we are confused about who we really are, because the mask that we are wearing in an everyday level doesn't seem to be the mask that we are wearing in a dream. So sometimes it seems that we are more authentic in our dream than we are in our waking life. And also, it seems that sometimes we are awakening into a more real world when we are sleeping, when we are dreaming, a more pure world that is not constructed by the matter that surrounds us, but it's constructed by our own thoughts, it's constructed by our own deep psyche. A very remarkable story comes from Jung's autobiography, where he says that one night he had a dream, and in this dream he was dreaming that there was a Eastern type of yogi meditating. And in his dream he realized that that Eastern yogi was himself. And he was dreaming in meditation his whole life. And Jung remarked that if that yogi, if that meditating wise man stops meditating, I will cease to exist. On a deeper level, what this means is that dreams are closer to the original truth. Dreams are closer to the original creative power of our thoughts. If you want to put it like that, dreams are still happening in a realm where our thoughts have power to create very freely. If you ever had a lucid dream in which you could do whatever you wanted, you will notice that in a dream state, you potentially have the power to change any of your surroundings and to change even the storyline of the dream that you're dreaming. So we are more closer to the original level of creation when thoughts started to create the entire universe. When we are awake, we are in our consensual reality that already has its physical laws, it already has its cultural laws, and we are more bound. Now, that all sounds very interesting, but you might think, okay, but what about a scientific explanation of dreams? What is science telling us? When we dream, are we actually in a different realm? Are we in an altered state of consciousness? Or what is it really happening? And you might be familiar with the common explanation of dreams that science gives us, and namely that is the explanation that in our sleep, in our REM sleep, which is a certain phase of our sleep where we tend to dream, the brain is processing all the input that it received during the day. And we all know that there is a lot of truth about it. We know that sometimes we experience something that comes back in a quirky way in our dreams. So there seems to be a lot of truth about the theory that the brain is processing our daytime experience, and that's what dreams are about. Physiologically, that would mean that our brain has started to form some neurological pathways when we had experiences during the daytime, when we learned something new. But in order for these neurological pathways to really become more permanent, the brain goes over them again and again, and that is what's happening in a dream. And surely this explanation sounds very logical. So do we have to dismiss it, saying this is not spiritual? I don't think so. I think what happens that partially dreams are really this. Dreams are the brain's activity to go through the day's experience and to work through it. Even the Tibetan school of dreams that is very profound acknowledges that there are types of dreams that they call karmic dreams. And what the Tibetans call the karmic dreams is exactly what our science describes. These are thought patterns occurring at night that derive from whatever we experience during the day. In more Eastern words to put that, this is a karmic dream. This is something that comes from our daytime karma. But at the same time, there are dreams that bring us into deeper levels of the psyche. The Western tradition of studying dreams goes back to Freud, the father of psychoanalysis, who wrote a whole book entitled The Interpretation of Dreams. His main interest was to study the human subconscious. And he said that the dreams that we dream at night, those are the via regia, the royal road to the subconscious. So he was the first who psychologically established the fact that if we dream, that dream has a manifest, but also a latent meaning. So while we dream, there is a story, and that story is the manifest content of the dream. But there is something behind that manifest content that is symbolizing something that is occurring, something that is happening within our psyche. Freud himself only thought that dreams have personal, individual character. He was not overly concerned with a collective meaning or a collective level of dreams. That was his students, Carl Gustav Jung's work, to discover that within every human dream, there is a layer, or there is a level, if you want to put it like that, that is individual, that concerns the person's individual life, individual karma. But also within every person's psyche, there is a collective level where we are all interconnected and where the human fate is shared. And by studying dreams from that perspective, it was Jung who discovered that we all have archetypal dreams. We have dreams that share the same symbols and the same contents that we find in myths and legends. And that is a very deep level of dream interpretation. And if we study Jungian psychology, we can be quite surprised how deep it goes when he's comparing myth fairy tales and the teachings that they contain for our psyche and how they relate to our own personal dreams and the teachings and the messages that are contained within those dreams just for ourselves. But apart from psychoanalysis or work of psychologists in general, in the West we can say that we tend to neglect our dreams quite much. In other words, we put a lot of importance on our waking reality, on what is happening actually in our physical life. And our dreams are best just a little bit of, interesting story that we can tell by breakfast, or if you go to a psychologist and it gives a little bit of food for the psychologist for thought. But apart from that, there are very few people in our culture, there are very few people that live in the West and live a westernized life that pay actually attention, deep attention to their dreams. But that is a cultural thing. And if we want to study dreams in a deep level, then we have to look at cultures that put a tremendous significance on dreams. There are cultures that regard dreams at least as important as our waking reality. One of the cultures that I'm thinking of is the Tibetan culture. Within the Tibetan culture, we find dream yoga. And dream yoga is a very serious discipline that is practiced within Buddhism for the purpose of understanding and practicing dreams. Understanding dreams and practicing dreaming. So within that Tibetan tradition, there is a system for monks and nuns, but also for lay people, to learn how they can become lucid in their dreams. Lucid dreaming is actually a phrase that is also known to Western psychology. And what it means that we are dreaming and we become aware of the fact that we are dreaming. That's what makes a dream lucid. So suddenly there is something occurring in a dream that makes us realize this can't be waking reality. This must be a dream. And in that moment, we become aware of the fact that we are dreaming. And Tibetan dream yoga is a system that actually teaches people to become lucid, more and more lucid in their dreams for longer and longer period of time. Once somebody is becoming lucid in their dreams, the dream is starting to behave differently than before. Before lucidity occurs, what happens in our dreams is that we just dream, and the dream is like a story. It's a little bit like a movie that we are watching. And we can be surprised that sometimes it's silly, sometimes it's nonsensical and it entertains us, sometimes it gets nightmarish and we become afraid. But in any case, it is something that is passive from our point of view. We can't change or add or act within that dream. But once lucidity is achieved, then that changes dramatically, because from that moment on, the dreamer can actually change the dream content. So he's very much in charge of what is happening in the dream, and of course can also act consciously. One of the advices that the Tibetan dream yoga, for example, gives is to realize that a fire that we dream about is not a real fire. It is only a dream. It is only a dream fire. And then you can actually, in your dream, put your hand into the fire without burning yourself. And then you realize that this is not the same kind of fire that what I can see in my waking reality. Now, practitioners of dream yoga take this discipline very seriously, and it requires a lot of commitment. It requires multiple times to wake up during the night, to do another set of meditation that prepares the mind to lucid dreaming. And it is practiced throughout decades, or sometimes it is practiced throughout the entire life. So we could ask, why do they do that? So I was fascinated by this system, and I was equally fascinated to find out why would they do that? Why would they put so much effort and energy and time into practicing dreaming? And there is a simple answer to that, namely that if you become lucid in your dreams, you can extend your daytime practice, your daytime spiritual practice, also into the dream world, which allows you to practice things like compassion, loving kindness, also during the night, which you can argue it doubles your lifetime, because you spend roughly, or maybe not doubles, but it extends your lifetime. You might dream maybe a couple of hours a day, and then those couple of hours are win. You win those hours for your spiritual practice. And that is already remarkable. But there is something even more remarkable. A reason why Tibetans practice this dream yoga is because they liken dreaming, they liken sleeping and dreaming with death. Because if we look at our waking state and our dream state, we realize that they are cyclic in their nature. Every night we go to sleep, every night we dream, and every morning we wake up. And every morning there's a new day that starts, and we go through that new day, and we practice, and we do things, and then we go to sleep again, and every night we fall asleep, and we go into the dream state again, and then we wake up, and it's daytime, and we go to sleep again, and we dream, and we wake up, and it continues forever and ever. And we can see that cyclical nature of dream and awakened state. It's very similar to what happens in nature. You know, the sun comes up, the sun goes down, the sun comes up, the sun goes down. Winter comes, springtime comes, and then again another winter and another spring. So we see a cyclical nature in existence. And the Buddhists who believe in reincarnation, they say that life and death is just a cyclical as day and night. So when we die, we get into a state of mind that is called in Tibetan the bardo state, the bardo of death state, to be precise. And that state is like an extended dream state. So the mind is conjuring up images, the mind is conjuring up entire worlds from those thoughts, feelings, and sentiments that we were harboring during our lives, and most specifically at the moment of death. That's the reason why the Tibetan Buddhists emphasize the importance of being able to die peacefully, to have a peaceful and happy death, because whatever thoughts we have at the moment of death, that is also the type of thought that we will have afterwards, that will generate those dreamy kind of images that fill our bardo state. So if someone, for example, dies in a very fearful state of mind, then they might end up in a nightmarish bardo and might see monsters and hellish visions. And those nightmarish states will produce a rebirth that is not very fortunate. But if somebody manages to die peacefully, in a balanced state of mind, then the bardo state will be quite balanced itself, and that will most likely lead to a positive rebirth. So practicing to dream equals practicing to die. And if a person gets really good at becoming lucid in their dreams, then there is a good chance that that lucidity goes over also into the state into which the mind goes after death. In other words, they will be lucid in their death. And according to Buddhist tradition, that is a great opportunity for enlightenment. It is a great opportunity for the soul to progress if it manages to go into a transition between life and death with full awareness. I became quite fascinated with the idea of learning how to lucid dream with the Tibetan dream yoga tradition. So I practiced it myself, and I found the instructions quite confusing to begin with, which involved things like concentrating on the throat chakra while meditating on the illusory nature of reality, or just getting into the habit of asking yourself during the day whether you're dreaming or whether you are asleep, whether you are awake or whether you are in the dream state, because the idea is that once you get into the habit of asking that question, whether you are dreaming or not, during the day, that habit will continue in the sleep state once it's well established, and then you just automatically start to ask that question also while you're dreaming, and that question itself can trigger the lucidity, the feeling of lucidity, because then you can look out for signs that tell you, yes, actually I'm dreaming because I'm seeing things that are not possible in the physical reality. And I must say that with the practice that I've done, the experiences that it produced were absolutely mind-boggling. So they did not just produce lucid dreams, but they produced dreams that were completely real. It's the only word that I can use. So I remember one dream where I woke up in a reality that was the exact replica of the reality that we experienced during the waking state. So there was no difference in my vision, in the way I could hear, in the way I could touch things, or even in the way my body felt, to the normal waking state. And the only difference was, and that's how I could tell that it was a dream, that I could change anything that I wanted to change. So it was a bit like Matrix style, that if you wanted a wall to disappear, the wall would instantly disappear. If you wanted a whole building to disappear, the whole building would disappear, because it was obeying your mind. And very shortly after I had that dream, I had another one. And in that dream, I was visited by a wise old man kind of figure, a wise old Chinese philosopher. And this philosopher was talking to me about dreaming. And he said things like, you know, you never can really know whether you're dreaming or whether you're awake, because anything that you experience in your waking state that would prove you that you're awake, that can be produced by the mind in the dream state. So there is really no checklist that you can go through. At any given time, you're both awake and asleep, depending on where you're looking it from. So he was telling me about the subjectivity of reality, how subjective our perception at any given time actually is. And I found that quite fascinating and interesting, and I felt honored that I got this teaching in my dream. So the next morning, I woke up and I went over to my friend, who I like to talk about these kind of things. And I remember we were sitting on her bed, and there was her dog, and there were pillows and blankets, and we were sitting in all this comfiness, and I could touch things and I could feel things, and I was happy. I was telling her that I had this dream, and she was quite fond of it. She said, yes, that's actually quite true. You know, you could always be in a dream without being able to check it. And I was saying, yeah, well, actually, this could be a dream. And she smiled back and she said, yes, this could be a dream. We both knew it wasn't, because we both knew it was real. But we said, yeah, theoretically, philosophically speaking, we could be right now in a dream. And the interesting thing happened afterwards, that's when I woke up. So what the philosopher said was illustrated by my false awakening that wasn't a real awakening, that was being in a dream that felt absolutely like reality. So the experiences one gets from this lucid dreaming training is that your definition of reality completely changes. And you understand that what Buddha said, namely that it is your mind that creates the world, is absolutely true. It's on an empiric, logical level, absolutely true. Nevertheless, we live in a culture where this kind of thinking is not very much cultivated. And as I already said, dreaming in itself is not very cultivated. It's not taken very seriously. For example, it was Saint Augustine himself who wrote in his Confessions that he felt lucky that his dreams are something that he's not responsible for, that he doesn't take accountancy for in front of God. Because he said, what I am in my dreams, that is not necessarily good. And I'm happy that I'm not responsible for who I am in my dreams. Of course, from a Tibetan or a reincarnationist perspective, you would say that, yes, you are very much responsible for what you're dreaming, because what you're dreaming is part of your subconscious, and your subconscious is who you are. So in order to become enlightened, your subconscious has to be cleansed and clear of all the rubbish of the past and all the garbage and all the negativity. So it's not quite true that we are not responsible for what we are dreaming. We are just responsible for it on a very deep and very intricate level. There was a poet and a writer from my own country, Mihai Bobic, who wrote a very interesting book. And this book is already a beginning critique, if you want to look at it like that, to the fact that we don't pay attention to our dreams. I briefly recall the plot of this book because it's remarkable. It's basically about a young man who's growing up under very privileged circumstances. And he's described as a golden youth. He's described as a young, talented, very intelligent, handsome young man who's studying mathematics, who is engaged with a very beautiful woman, who has money, who has social status. And he describes in the first person what a lucky, what a privileged life he has. But then he also says, I wish my life wouldn't be as beautiful as this. I wish my dreams would be beautiful. Because what happens to this young man, that while he's living this privileged life, every evening when he goes to sleep, he has a nightmare. And the nightmare is always the same. In his nightmare, he's a poor shoe shop boy who's working at a shoe shop, but it's not, doesn't even know what's really happening to him. He's tolerated there, but he's treated very badly. He has the vague idea that he would need to get an education, that he would need to go to some school to get out of that situation in which he is, but he's very dependent, very poor, abused, he gets beaten, he gets tortured psychologically, physically. And his life is so miserable that it is equivalent to a real nightmare. So this young privileged man wakes up every night, not relaxed, not happy. And his nightmares are becoming worse and worse. And it's deteriorating his life. And he's spending more and more nights just out drinking, amusing himself so that he doesn't have to fall asleep because he's afraid of his own dreams. And one day he's approaching his own wedding. And he thinks that he can't marry his bride without telling her what's plaguing him, what's hurting him, what is causing him so much suffering. So before the wedding, he decides to tell this story. And he tells that young woman, who's his bride, what he's going through. And she's thinking and she's saying, I think you should commit suicide, like in your dream. Like make that poor boy get a gun put to his head and pull the trigger. And then he's gone and you don't have to suffer so much anymore. And a young man takes the advice. And he shoots himself in his dream. And then the book is over. And there is a postscriptum. And the postscriptum is nothing but a article from a local newspaper that says, a remarkable death occurred. They found a young man shot dead in his bed. And there was no gun and there was no murderer. There was no trace. It's a mysterious death that police couldn't say how it occurred. So this story illustrates the point that we can't cut away ourselves from our dreams. Our dreams come from the non-physical world, and they set causes for effects that are happening in the physical world. So it would be very therapeutic for all of us to pay attention to our dreams. Even though our society and our culture does not necessarily do so. Patricia Garfield, who wrote a book entitled Creative Dreaming, she said in her book that it is up to us what kind of importance we give our dreams. She said, you can set your own rewards to encourage yourself and to give yourself the initiative to take your own dreams seriously, even if your society doesn't give it any importance. Patricia Garfield also recalls the story of the Senoi people in Malaysia. And she describes these people as very simple indigenous type of people who live, you know, in the land. They don't have great wealth. They don't have any external civilization that is remarkable. But she describes them as having a very remarkable inner civilization. And she describes these people as having basically no psychological issues, having no neuroses. She describes them as very calm people, very balanced and harmonious adults. And then she describes what they do with their dreams. And in her description, she says that when the Senoi are children and they wake up early in the morning and go and have breakfast with their mother and father and their siblings, they are asked by their mother and father, "What did you dream?" And then they are encouraged to tell their dreams. And then the entire family sits together and they analyze what the kids have been doing in their dreams. For example, if they had a nightmare and they were chased by someone, then mother and father ask, "What did you do with the person who's chasing you?" And if the kids say that they ran away or they woke up, then they are encouraged to go back into the same dream. They are encouraged to learn lucid dreaming, and they are encouraged to go back into the same dream and find a different ending to it. "Don't run away. Confront your enemy," they say. Whatever conflict or whatever danger comes up in your dreams, these Senoi children are encouraged to conquer it. And also they are encouraged, which is equally remarkable, to always advance towards a positive outcome, towards a pleasurous outcome. Now, this is very interesting. And as an anthropologist, I've been trying to trace down documented material about a Senoi that is more than that one book that I could find. And unfortunately, I couldn't verify or find anything more than that. But regardless of that, the idea in itself is very, very true, psychologically very, very true, that if we could teach our subconscious, and by teaching our subconscious also teach our conscious mind to not run away, to confront whatever comes up in life, and then turn it into a positive outcome, we would turn into psychologically healthy people. That is the essence, in my opinion, also of positive thinking. We've been spoken, you know, we spoke about the law of attraction last time. The essence of positive thinking is not to put those pink glasses on, as they say in my home country, and see everything in a pink and in a rosy light. True positive thinking means that you see the problems, but you see them from a problem-solving orientation. You're immediately identifying the problem as something that is to be solved and to be turned into a positive, into a good outcome. And we can learn that in our dreams. We can learn it in our meditations, because the cause that will set a positive effect is always on the level of our thoughts, it's always on our level of our energies, it always is on the level of our feelings. It is not an external cause, it is an internal cause that will shift our perspective from negative to positive. Dreams are very creative. Dreams are a fantastic source for artistic creativity and also for finding new insights. I mean, the story of science is full of dreams. We can think of the famous story about Kekule, who was trying to find the benzol molecule structure. And he was working on it for years and years and years, not trying to find a satisfying structure that would explain how the molecule is put together, until, as the story goes, he was sitting at a fire and he was falling into a light sleep in which the flames of the fire started to become alive. And out of the flame came the mythological snake of Ouroboros, who's biting its own tail. So he saw this fiery circle of a mythological snake biting its own tail, this circle. And from the dream, Kekule awoke, knowing that the structure of the molecule is a circle. Similarly, rumor has it that Mendeleev found the idea for his periodic system of elements in a dream. Partly Einstein found ideas for his theory of relativity in a dream. Many stories of literature like, for example, the story of Jekyll and Hyde, a lot of Stevenson stories, they all come from dreams. So what can we do ourselves if we want to pay more attention to our dreams? Well, first of all, we can just put the intention out. It makes a huge difference that we intend and we plan to remember our dreams. We can even, like the Tibetans do, during our daily routine, program our minds to remember our dreams. You know, those of you who can do visualization, they can actually program, then you can program your mind to remember your dreams. And then one important thing that will allow you to remember your dreams better is that you catch them just when you're waking up. So you might have noticed that yourself, that you remember the dream just when you woke up. But as soon as you started doing something, even simple things like putting your shoes on or brushing your teeth, made the dream go away. So when you have that state of awakening, when your eyes are still closed, but you're starting to become conscious of being awake, then it helps to stay with your eyes closed, rehearse the dream, so that it starts to become part of your waking memory. And then when you open your eyes, you have a dream diary, a piece of paper or a notebook at your bedside, and you just write down the dream as soon as it was remembered. And keeping a dream diary is interesting because it will help you to remember your dreams better, but it will also help you to see the structure of your dreams and how they evolve. Because the most interesting thing about dreams is that they evolve. They behave accordingly to our own spiritual growth. So as we evolve, so do our dreams. Or you might get more ambitious and check out Tibetan dream yoga and find a way to become lucid in your dreams. But there is a warning, because if you become lucid in your dreams, something else might occur to you. You might leave your body and have genuine out-of-body experiences. And when I say warning, I say that with a smile on my face, because those out-of-body experiences are probably the most interesting, the most mind-opening, and most progressive experiences that you can have as a human being on the planet. And if you want to know more about them, tune into our next metaphysical podcast. Until then, sleep well, enjoy the full moon, and have beautiful dreams. Thank you for listening.